This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. This morning I wanted to give another talk, a sort of a end of series talk on this transmission that I've been speaking about over the last few teshos. And this is from the Transmission of Light of Master Keizan, the 35th ancestor Qingyuan. Qingyuan went to study with Zen Master Huainong and asked, "What work is to be done so as not to fall into stages?" The Zen master inquired, "What have you done?" Qingyuan said, "I do not even practice the holy truths." Huainong said, "What stage do you fall into?" Qingyuan said, "If I don't even practice the holy truths, what stages are there?" Master Huainong recognized his profound capacity. Keizan's verse. Coming and going on the bird's path, there are no tracks. How can you look for stages on the mystic road? What work is to be done so as not to fall into stages? If we think of the Buddha's teaching and practice pointing to alleviating suffering and the path being to free ourselves of all attachments or to illuminate and enlighten all our false views, in a sense, the question becomes, having discovered the path, is how earnestly do we take it up? How much faith do we have in it? In a sense, how seriously do we take our own possibilities in terms of what our life can be? How important is it to us how we are in the world and what our contribution is? And this ultimately doesn't really have to do with monk or lay practice, or it really has to do with those questions, I think. And this koan, this question, what work is to be done so as not to fall into stages, is kind of important. Because within it is really every way in which we get tripped up and trip ourselves up and other people. Huainong, I've spoken about a little bit in the last talks, and his humble beginnings as it's portrayed in the Platform Sutra, which is purportedly the sutra in which he is expounding the Dharma. It's thought that his rise to prominence within the tradition was really brought about by one of his successors who wanted to, in a sense, elevate his position by elevating his teachers. And as I've said, that historically, or you know, from an academic perspective, has interest and importance, but in terms of, you know, the fact that that sutra remains is because of what's in it. And the ways in which the story of Huainong and other masters are continued to be told is because of, for the valuable merit that has, is for the value that has in terms of our own development. Now, it's said that Huainong, in speaking to Qingyuan, who was one of his disciples, so this is again, very early in the history of the Zen tradition. So Bodhidharma transmitted to Hweka, and then to Shitao, and then to Hongren, and then to Huainong. So the sixth ancestor. So this is very early. And Huainong transmitted to Nanwei, that led to the whole Rinzai, ultimately to the whole Rinzai lineage, Nanwei and Matsu and Linji, and then on down to Isai in Japan, and Dogen, who studied with maybe Isai, but more certainly his disciple Myozen, and so was studying within the Rinzai tradition. So Dogen did all of this Rinzai training before he went to China and had contact with all of the koan training. But then another successor of Huainong was Qinguan, who transmitted to Dongshan, I mean, the lineage of, that led down to Dongshan, and then down to Zhuqing, who Dogen studied with in China, and then to Dogen, and now down to us. And so from Huainong were these two lines that ultimately led to these two sort of predominant and still existing schools in the Zen tradition, the Linji and the Gaodong. And so it said that Huainong was once speaking to Qinguan and said, since ancient times, the robe and the teaching, the robe of Bodhidharma, I spoke about that, how the actual kesa, the okesa of Bodhidharma, was transmitted to Hweka as a symbol of having received the transmission, that there have been within sort of the transmission history, there's always been ways to indicate that that has happened, so that there's some sort of symbol of authority or of empowerment. And so the robe was one of those things. And so since ancient times, the robe and the teaching have been passed on together from teacher to disciple. The robe represents faith, while the teaching seals the mind seal. Huainong said, now that I have found suitable people, that is good heirs, good successors, why worry that whether they will or will not be believed? In other words, having faith in the Dharma and having faith in these disciples, to not worry so much about how people perceive it. Ever since I received the robe, Huainong said, I've had a lot of trouble, and there will surely be even more competitiveness in later generations. Therefore, the robe will be left in this monastery as a keepsake. In other words, I won't pass that on. You should spread the teaching and not let it die out. You know, and I know when I encountered these stories about, you know, this samsara, basically, you know, within these realms, you know, of teachers and disciples and monasteries, and you think, well, wait a minute, you know, I thought you guys had sort of taken care of all of that. But then there it is. And even in Dogen's lineage, when Dogen died, he transmitted to Ajo, who was his closest disciple and had come from another Buddhist tradition. And had it's very interesting, which I won't get into today, but it's very interesting how Ajo came to Dogen, and really, because he was already part of a Buddhist tradition that he was very much a part of. But he had a first encounter with Dogen that was so-so, but then he had another encounter and he realized there's something going on here. There's something that this person is teaching that is both compelling and that I don't understand. And so he ended up leaving that tradition and becoming a disciple of Dogen, and so did a number of other disciples. And that was the Daruma school in Japan. And so when Dogen transmitted to Ajo, and then Dogen died, and Ajo assumed the role of abbot at Aichi, he did that for about 14 years or so. And then he wanted to retire, and so he transmitted to Gikai, Tetsu Gikai, who we chant in our lineage, and who Dogen had a very close relationship to as well. Gikai was really drawn towards more esoteric teachings and practices. And so he began to incorporate those into his training at the monastery. And there were a lot of his students who didn't like that. And so there was a conflict. They sort of rebelled, and they sort of rose up and forced him out And so he was succeeded by Gyan, who was another disciple. And they actually designated him as the third abbot, sort of ignoring Gikai. And but eventually, Gikai came back and stepped back in to that. And so Gikai is how we chant the lineage. And so there again, there was scuttlebutt. And so our false views, our binding emotions, our greed, anger, and delusion, our pride and jealousy, our righteousness continues until it doesn't. It continues to be strong until and when it is transformed by us. And it is transformed to the degree that we transform it. To the degree that we have not, it still has power. It still has energy. And so wearing a robe, sitting in Zazen, living in a monastery, shaving one's head, being ordained, the only thing, all of that's upaya. The only thing that really ensures the integrity of our own practice is our own commitment to it. Now, there's a lot of sort of supporting actors in that, right? We're not doing that on our own, not by a long shot.
But holding ourselves accountable when we need to be, who are responding well when we are held accountable by others. In other words, we are the ones who have the sole responsibility, primarily, the primary responsibility, to ensure that we continue to be a student of the Bible. So we have to know for ourselves what is right and what is not right. When do we need to apply more effort? When do we need to relax? And the whole point is that we're becoming more and more skillful within ourselves and looking for all of the various ways in which we fall into something, a stage, a rank, a role, a complacency, an identity, a new identity, an accomplishment. I mean, you know, the world is pretty much your marketplace, your Walmart for options. On every shelf, there's something you can pick up, and we can turn that into something. And when we come into practice, we just have a whole other department in which to go shopping. Right? And to take off of these Dharma shelves things and just incorporate them into our samsara. And we don't have to do that. We will. Everybody does, right? Because why would we think that all of our ways of being would just stop the moment we pass through? Okay, I mean, come on. That's just not realistic. So they will continue. We will continue to do those same things we've done before. We will fall into stages and ranks and competitiveness and righteousness and all of this stuff. And what makes this not just a group of people who come in confused and chaotic and continue to be confused and chaotic, is our intention, our commitment to be free, to realize in self the body, mind, and self and mind, and holding ourselves to that commitment every day. That we can do. That's challenging, but samsara is a whole lot more challenging when you really think about it. And we know where that's going. Right? We don't need more studies to help us understand where that trajectory is going. To be without contrivance, to be without artifice, to really examine our grasping The habits of mind and body, emotions and activity, our false views, the ways we try to make ourselves and others in the world match our mind's creation. So our minds create the perfect world, right? Our minds are very good at creating these habits. But the world just doesn't work. And so if we only get the comfort, it's in the end of these books. And so it's like samsara is trying to succeed at dukkha. And so that success would be you have only what you want. You never have anything you don't want. You only have to be a good for one thing. You never have to be with anything you don't want to do it. Right? You got that fixed. And then you can stand solidly within the skandhas, within your perceptions, as yourself, and claim permanence. Now, the fact that that's never happened, and is it possible, hasn't stopped us from trying. As I said, even if contrivance ends, there's still some preservation of the self. And that can be hard to understand. I mean, I used to be very confused about that. Like, if we experience the ultimate realm, then why doesn't that basically fix everything? How can we still have a false view? If we realize that to be attached to things is illusion, okay, we see that it's illusion, we realize the emptiness of our attachments, then why would we still attach? And so just that we don't understand the complexity of this system we call the human mind, the mind, its intricacies, its brilliance, but also the ways in which it is so built into itself to preserve that sense. And so even if contrivance is, there's still some preservation of yourself. The Buddha said, that's the thing that lingers and lingers and lingers and lingers. He says, if you were like this, you make the mistake of falling into the deep pit of liberation. And so this state has always been called religious attachment. Religious righteousness, which is its own particular brew of madness, right? And it's very particular because it's standing on the ground of the ultimate. So it's, we think, and that it is all about peace and harmony and love and compassion. And so, but then there it is arising as suffering and competitiveness and judgment. And anger and acrimony. So, it would be reasonable to ask, well, if that's our penchant to fall into these ranks, why don't we just not have any? Let's just not have any. Right? I think that's a very good project to take up. Create such a thing. Where people are actually included. That doesn't give rise to all of this. Because it's in all of us. We bring it with us. And so rather, what training does is something very daring. In a sense, something very dangerous. Which is that it creates those very things that we fall into. So that from within, we can see them for
what they are, free ourselves from what they're not, and put them to good use. And then to do that, not just within the religious forms that we use, but within every place. That's kind of brilliant, too, when you think about it. And so Qinghuan says, I do not practice the holy truths. And Huainong says, well, what stage do you fall into? And he says, well, if I don't practice the holy truths, what stages are there? Now, as an idea, as a concept, this is delusional. And it leads to, why practice? You don't need to practice. Everything's empty. Or those stages and all of the stuff of religious practice is just going to entrap you, so just eliminate all of it. But as realized experience, what Qinghuan is saying is very profound. It is prajnaparamita. It is the holy truths themselves manifested. In the outlines of practice, which is the one teaching of Bodhidharma that scholars feel pretty sure is directly attributable to him, he says there are four outlines of practice. He says, first, we need to face suffering, to understand our karma, to understand our actions and the actions of others, the actions of systems, and know how to meet suffering, how to experience it, and to begin to free ourselves of our ideas and our reactivity, the ways we collapse, we get paralyzed, we numb, we act out, we react, we respond in learned ways. Recognizing that delusion causes pain. Pain almost always leads to anger once we acknowledge it. Anger seeks a target. The target of that anger experiences pain. That gives rise to anger. That seeks a target. And on it goes. And so we have to learn how to suffer. Right? We might not think about that. We think, oh, I thought we were going to like get out of that. Free ourselves of suffering. Absolutely. Yes. And the only way to do that, we have to begin by learning how to suffer, because that's where we are. There is no getting around that on the path to freeing ourselves. So how do I suffer in this particular form? Right? And then as I meet all of the various forms, oh, I never knew. Right? I always thought suffering was sort of, you know, could be kept contained in these, in this sort of category of things. But as we study the Buddha's First Noble Truth, we realize life as dukkha is profound in its breadth and its subtlety. All the various things that we never even thought about, where we are actually suffering, actually not at ease. And learning how to not just recognize that, but to experience it in a way that becomes, is our liberation. Then Bodhidharma says we have to adapt to conditions. He says, as mortals, we're ruled by conditions. All the suffering and joy we experience depend on conditions. So the Buddha said, one who sees dependent arising, that all things arise in dependence on conditions, sees the Dharma. And one who sees the Dharma sees dependent arising. They're the same. He's saying they're the same. And then in that very important teaching, he said, there being this, that exists. When this comes into being, that comes into being. When this ceases, that ceases. When this condition arises, this effect comes into being. When that condition ceases to arise, this ceases to be. So he's both in that very sort of dense, very succinct teaching is really talking about how everything comes into being. Bodhidharma says, all the suffering and joy we experience depend on conditions. None of them just exist on their own. And to really reflect on how profound that is, right? Everything is caused. Everything comes into being. So then what are the conditions? What's the land, the landscape, the ground? what's going on that brings this into being? So that when we're sitting and there's tension or there's anxiety or there's numbness or apathy or whatever we're experiencing, that arises because certain conditions have made that possible. So what are those conditions? What if we shift, right? Adapt to that. And adapting doesn't mean to, in the way we adapt to our suffering, our misery, just by, you know, trying to like mold ourselves around it. Pretend it's not so, but adapting means to meet it with skillfulness. I mean, that's really so much of what's happening in practice is we're learning, how do I meet this, right? We put so much attention in the this part of it. What's out there, right? What's causing me pain or what's giving me joy? But really what Buddhism is doing is bringing our attention to the mind, right, that is meeting that. The way we meet it is the result of our karma. The way we're meeting it now is the creation of new karma, which is either strengthening what doesn't work very well or releasing us from that. And then Bodhidharma says, to seek nothing. People of this world are deluded. They're always longing for something, always in a world seeking. But the wise wake up. They bring their minds to what is true and sublime and let their bodies change with the seasons. We don't try and control everything. We're not trying to aggressively dominate. To dwell in the three realms is to dwell in a burning house. To have a body is to suffer. Does anyone with a body know peace? And we might really react and say, well, wait a minute, you know, the body, like, kind of cool, you know, that we have one, you get to have one, right? You get, moves you around, right? You do things in it, right? It's kind of cool. Is it only suffering? To have a body is to suffer, right? Could there be suffering without the body? How does suffering appear in the body? In all of its variety of ways. The Buddha, right, at the very end of his deeply enlightened life, was in a body that was old, creaky, right? He got very sick at the end of his life. And so in a sense, there is still that, all of that within the body as long as we have this body. But to understand what he means when he says that the third outline of practice is to seek nothing, we really have to seek deeply in order to understand this. We can only discover this by seeking, by hearing the Dharma, practicing it. And along the way, we will attach, we will create suffering, just as we have within samsara. But now, increasingly, we're able to see that. We see ourselves creating. We see ourselves reaching for something that takes us away. We see ourselves turning, recoiling from something, trying to move away from it. And seeing that is not in and of itself alone enough, but it changes everything. It makes all things possible. In the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra of 8,000 lines, the Buddha said, the perfection of this great wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, allows you to not have to lean on any dharma. Because you see that all dharmas have no ground. You don't have to lean on them. Taking refuge is not leaning on the dharma. it is not attaching to something spiritual. It is what allows us to do everything. And then finally, there's practicing the Dharma. Bodhidharma said, the Dharma is the truth that all natures are pure. By this truth, all appearances are empty. Defilement and attachment, subject and object, don't exist as we believe they do. And since that which is true, which is ultimate, includes nothing worth begrudging, because there is nothing to grab onto, things don't exist in the way they appear to us, then the bodhisattva can give their body, their life, their property in selfless giving, without regret, without any sense of giver, gift, recipient, without bias, without clinging, attachment. And they can offer this to others without becoming attached to form. And thus, through their own practice, they're able to help others and glorify the way of enlightenment. And as with Dana Paramita, they also practice the other paramitas. But while practicing the paramitas to free ourselves of delusion, they practice nothing at all. This is what is meant by practicing the Dharma. Practicing nothing at all means not falling into stages. I do not practice the holy truths. I do not fall into any stages. What stages are there? To be attached to things is illusion. What is this thing that I am attached to? And so this warning that Kazan gives about attaching to emptiness, sometimes we attach to an idea of emptiness without having had any direct experience. Having had the direct experience, it's very common, probably universal, that the student attaches not to emptiness, because that's not possible, because it is not something we can attach to, but to the idea of it. And so there again, even though we've had a direct experience that there is no thingness, the mind does what it has done forever. It creates an object that at one moment was an intimate, direct encounter, and then the next instant it begins to create, objectify, form, create, bring into existence something in our mind that is no longer that experience, is no longer that direct experience. And so that's why training is continuing and continuing and continue to relinquish, and to see more and more deeply, to not fall into anything. Kazan says, even those who go all the way to the final stages of training, as long as there is any vestige of clinging, has still not seen Buddha nature clearly. The Buddha said that this is because they still maintain that the teachings have objective reality. And so they still set up practice as something that is. And therefore, their understanding is not yet fully clear. And so, because the Buddha said that sense of self continues to rise, even after a person is highly developed, is not a mistake, and from our perspective, it's not even a problem. It can become problematic, right, when the practitioner does not see that, does not recognize it, becomes subject to it. But the fact that it arises is not a problem. It being a problem becomes a problem, right? Because now it is an objective reality that now we have to do something about. And so if we think about this in terms of how we practice, you know, from all of the not so subtle, just you know, flotsam and jetsam that arises, you know, in our mind stream that crashes into us and we crash into it, every thoughts and memories and concerns and emotions, all of the stuff, right? And in its first arising, there's just a moment of contact, but then very quickly, before we even know it, without our even seeing it, it assumes the shape of something that now has weight, solidity, substance, qualities, characteristics, power, and it's happening to me. We become subject to that object. When that calms down a bit, and there's just the breath, or there's just awareness, and that sense of self, someone who is practicing, someone who is calm, someone who just let go, right? There's that sense of, oh, my mind just opened, or oh, that my tension just relaxed. That sense of self arises, right? And appears in that moment. To see that just as clouds and mist, just the sense of something. And to not objectify, to not recognize it as a problem. It's a function of our consciousness. When we reify it and dwell in it and then adorn it and samsarize it, then it becomes powerful and something that in reality it is not. It is not that thing. But it is in our experience, it is that thing. And that's what gets us. And so to be able to sit and practice in the body, in the motion, in the thought, in the experiences that are arising, and to be not denying and not grasping is how we are developing the capacity to face discomfort, to face suffering, to face something I don't want to face. No, I don't want this. And if I follow that, then there's more suffering. There's just more of that. But if I just hold steady, right, and practice letting my mind not, but rather, you see the difference? Then a whole nother world does not arise. That whole other world does not arise. And we can do that at any point along the creation of our world. We are God. Remember many years ago, I've told this story, Dada Roshi and I were at a conference of prison clergy, ministers and clergy from all different traditions. And I don't even remember what the conference was about, but he was asked to speak because we were the only Buddhists there. And so they had some questions. And one of the, and it's predominantly Christian clergy, I would say. Some imams, some rabbis. And one of the clergy says, you know, how, as a Buddhist, do you understand God? Or something like that. And I don't remember exactly what Dada Roshi did, but it was essentially, and I was like, oh my goodness. I literally looked for the door. I thought, okay, if we have to leave really fast. And I thought, okay, how is he going to, like, what's the next thing he's going to do? Right? How is he going to, is he going to explain this? Is he going to just, like, let it sit? But is that not, in fact, do we not create the world? We don't need 7 days. Right? Done. So in the Prajnaparamita, it says, do not generate the sense of the skandhas are empty, or I am practicing, or I am a bodhisattva. The Buddha said, just practice without bringing up such ideas. As I practice, I don't practice, I am calm, I am entering into concentration. That was a good period of zazen. I am developing nicely. I am no good at this. My mind is a mess. I am. And that when that sense of I am arises, to not meet that with, I should not be thinking that. That's just another I am. In other words, that's the part of it. Just relax. It doesn't have to be stopped. It doesn't have to be put on a pedestal. Just let it stop. It will. It will stop of its own. It will calm. Its nature is calm. Its nature is calm. The nature of everything that arises inside and outside of ourselves is, in its essence, non-harming. Things are, in essence, non-harming. That's why the principle of ahimsa is so essential in Buddhism, because it's the fundamental of every living and inanimate thing. Non-harming in the sense that its nature is not to cause harm. Then why is there so much harm-making about the worlds that we create about all of those things? And they can be material things or immaterial things. They can be flickers of light or energy in our mind. We are masters of taking anything and building it into something. And so the Buddha is just saying, we don't have to do that. And so all of that self-referencing is what we're just relaxing. When it comes fully formed as a thought, a memory, an emotion, so on and so on, it's already built into that. When the mind becomes very calm, sometimes just that vestige arises, that sense of I am, which is progress, actually. Because now it's more just a shadow, right? It has much less flesh and bones on it. It's more just a wisp of something. It's much lighter. The Buddha says, ultimately, don't go near any dharma at all, as all dharmas are unapproachable. You cannot appropriate them. They cannot be possessed, seized, owned, gotten. And so Chiwan is speaking of this when he says, I do not even practice the holy truths. I do not fall into stages. And so Bodhidharma says, while practicing the paramitas to liberate our delusion, practice nothing at all. This is what is meant by practicing the Dharma. In other words, as we are practicing, do not reify, solidify, objectify ourselves and the practice in doing so. Just practice. Shikantaza is just sit. To just sit. Don't do anything else. Don't create something about that. We call it shikantaza so we can refer to it. But the word doesn't mean anything beyond the meaning that we give to it. It's sort of like a symphony. There are instruments, musicians, conductors, music hall, musical notation, training, audiences, ears, consciousness. But none of that is music. No single one of those things is, you can't find music in any one of those things. You can't find music when you look at a sheet of music notation. What we call music is something that happens dependent upon conditions. It arises in its very creation. The musician becomes what we call a musician in the moment that they begin to make sound. An orchestra becomes itself in the moment that all of those strings start to move. The conductor doesn't exist without the musician sitting in front of them and the audience. Nothing exists apart from its creation. A sangha is just like that. We ourselves are just like that. We are nothing but the arising of conditions, which frees us from having to be something, having to maintain, right, some permanent structure. That's why Huainung said, no mind is realizing that thoughts are empty while thinking. No form is to be free from the thingness of things while relating to things. And non-abiding is your original nature. And so if we want to realize our nature, we ourselves have to be non-abiding, not fall into stages, not be objectifying. And so Keizan says, coming and going on the bird's path, there are no tracks. Right? Such a beautiful image. The birds are flying, you see them. Right? And there's no track, right? But every once in a while, a feather falls. On this bird's path, there are no tracks. How can you look for stages on the mystic road? Right? We look behind, we want to see how far we've been, how we've gone, we will look ahead, how much farther do we have? As Trungpa said, it's like falling from a plane. There's no ground. So it's okay that you forgot to put on your parachute. Even the idea of falling, right? When there's no ground, when you look up and there's only limitless sky, what does falling mean, actually? There's just and that includes everything. Next week, we're going to, on Sunday, a week from today, we're going to be starting Ango. And so this will be our third online Ango. We will have a chief disciple, Shinji. Linda Shinji Hoffman is our chief disciple. And so, which is possible because she lives close enough to be able to, and it has life circumstances in which she can quarantine and be here for some part of March and some part of May. So she'll be here for some residential training and sessions. And so for her and our benefit, we'll have that opportunity. This Thursday, we're going to have a Sangha meeting all together, a sort of fireside chat to catch up on some things. So please come to that if you can on Thursday. We will be continuing to track what is going on with COVID and the vaccinations. People are getting vaccinated within the Sangha. Some people are and are asking, so can I come? And so we're, you know, working with our expert advisors and sort of tracking that and waiting until there's enough information to have confidence that the time has come where that can happen. We all want it, right? So it's just waiting until it really feels like it's the right time. On Saturday, we'll do a Zazen Kai together here next week as a way of beginning the Ango. We'll do a Zazen Kai rather than a weekend session or peaceful dwelling and other kinds of openings we've done to make it easier for all of us to be a part of it together. So I hope you can join us for that. So winter is, despite the snow that's still on the ground, is slowly giving way to spring. And so one of the signs of that is the beginning of Ango. And so we will be bidding adieu to our winter training. and be getting ready to come together for peaceful dwelling practice for the spring. So please come together this week if you can with us. This day departs as it arrives freely. This day departs as it arrives freely. Where do you find yourself? To have faith in this Dharma, these Dharma teachings, is an invitation in. How is that so? How is it so that this day, this moment, this arising, this quandary, arises as it departs freely? Where do you find yourself? The answer is always in the question. The answer is in the question. And so we have to lean in. Come close.
Thanks for listening. Did you know that Zen Mountain Monastery is live streaming all Dharma talks and daily Zazen during the coronavirus quarantine? Visit our website to learn about all the online programs being offered at this time. Just go to zmm.org and click on the link at the very top of the page, or scroll down and click on Retreats.